Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. And hey, we're road tripping today on the Larry Mueller Show. And I'm really looking forward to talking with our guests today. We're live from Fish Creek, and we're broadcasting from the Northern Sky Theater. Woo! And as you can tell, there is a very large audience to be with us today. It's great to see so many people in this wonderful theater, and it's great to have three guests to start the show today to talk about the theater. LaCrissa Granberry, a performer, playwright, and she's the NOVA program director, and we'll learn some more about that later. But LaCrissa, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining in.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, she is a large personality, I can tell you that. She has got a personality like you wouldn't believe. Doc Heidi is the artistic advisor, a co-founder of the company, and a playwright. And Doc, I saw you last night. You were wearing red long johns.
That's true.
In a play. And it's great to see you with kind of normal clothes on.
It's a relief to be wearing normal clothes.
With us as well, Jeff Herbst. Jeff, I saw last night as well, the artistic director of Northern Sky Theater. Jeff, thank you for joining in as well.
My pleasure, Larry.
So, I hope you'll join in with your questions. We're going to get some questions from the audience that are right here live and looking at me right now. But if you're listening in on the radio, you can certainly call in with your own questions or comments. What does it feel like to be in front of hundreds of people? Have you been involved in your own theater or plays? Are you wondering more about community theater? Maybe have questions about this year's lineup at Northern Sky Theater. We're certainly going to be talking about that as well. Whatever is on your mind, the number to call, 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Jeff, for people who've never been and who aren't here in the audience, obviously, right now, tell us about the Northern Sky Theater, its locations, and so forth.
Well, we have two theaters, actually. One is in Peninsula State Park, and performances out there in the park have been going on for now over 50 years. Northern Sky has been out there since 1990. And then we, in 2019, we opened up the Gould Theater, which is our indoor space, which is where we're broadcasting from today.
It's a beautiful space.
Oh, thanks, Larry. Yeah, we're proud of it. And it's a great place to have a home. We do all original programming at Northern Sky Theater, for those who don't know what we're up to. And what that means is everything is homegrown. We started out as a really kind of a nuclear company, and all of our material came from the people who were working together. We created the works, we acted in the works, we did everything, and it was a really small troupe. And then we started to expand. Unfortunately, we lost one of our seminal contributors, Fred Alley, way too young in 2001. But since then, we have recruited more writers, including LaCrissa Granberry, who's with us today, and we've kind of opened up the stable of writers so that we can get more material in, and that's what our continuing mission is to do all original programming. A lot of it, Larry, is reflective of Wisconsin culture, Wisconsin people, so it really has a lot of resonance, I think, for our audiences.
Oh, I would definitely agree with you on that. Doc, you've been around, I mean, you go way the heck back.
Oh, that's true, Larry. not quite as far back as you.
You're a co-founder at all.
I am, yes, that's true. Mm-hmm.
So, from your perspective, I mean, what caused you to want to start this up, and how do you feel about its growth over time?
Oh, gosh. Well, as you mentioned, I first got involved actually 51 years ago. What we now call Northern Sky, grew out of a project at the University of Wisconsin called the Heritage Ensemble. I was a college student and got involved. I was actually majoring in psychology, so it was kind of an avocation, but I loved it and continued with it. And then in 1990, the founder of the Heritage Ensemble, Dave Peterson, retired and gave the theater to a couple of us, and we reformulated it to have a focus more on what we call book musicals, which is shows that have characters and plot and so on. And it grew from a very, very tiny thing that originally charged 25 cents, 50 cents, I'm not quite sure, now is an enormous professional operation, and I feel absolutely delighted and greatly privileged to still be with it.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you are, and I'm sure the rest of the company is as well. LaCrystal, let me turn to you. Tell us about your journey to eventually become a returning performer here at Northern Sky Theater.
Yeah.
Yeah, is right.
I started in 2018 was my first season at Northern Sky, so I feel the youngest of these two legends here.
The rose between two thorns, for sure. Wow.
Larry said it, so it must be true. But I started in 2018, and I've been back now for the last seven seasons. This is my seventh season here, and I keep coming back because I like it. Kind of love it a little bit.
Yeah, and you've been, you, this wasn't just your first rodeo.
No. I mean, it was my first rodeo as a writer, though. I'll tell you that. My very first musical that I wrote, which was Sunflowered, along with Aida Pirzada and Alyssa Rohde, that was the first musical that I wrote, and it was here. And the second one is here. So now, you know, rodeo as a writer is real for LaCrystal at Northern Sky Theater.
And I did want to mention that your works here, and I think, Jeff, you mentioned it. You write and produce everything. And good friends with the folks at Peninsula, Players?
Oh, there's great rapport between all of the professional companies up here, for
sure.
Yeah,
so I think there are four, aren't
there? There are four, that's correct. Yep.
Yeah, so it's great that way. And back to LaCrystal for a minute, because I don't want to forget about it, because you're the director of NOVA, which is Nurturing Original Voices and Artists.
That is.
Did I get it right?
You got it right. Nurturing Original Voices and Artists. It's our incubator for the next generation of writers coming along. Northern Sky has been producing original works since forever, as Jeff and Doc just shared. And because we do that, Jeff and I had a conversation on a back porch, I don't know, probably 3 years ago.
It was during the pandemic, right?
It was. Mm-hmm. In the dead of winter. We sat outside, all the snow around us, and we talked about what does it look like to work with new writers who are both finding their voices, exploring their voices, and wanting to write stories but not knowing where to start, because I sort of did that here and had guidance from both Molly Rohde and Jeff Herbst on how to write a musical, and I was like, I think other people would want to do this and need that same sort of guidance, and And I would say you both were like, great, you do that, LaCrystal. And so it's been a joy to have a lot of writing circles, bringing in new writers, exploring their voices, being challenged in their writing, getting peer feedback from other writers, having a safe space.
Well, it's great. Ages of these folks at the
company? Oh, they span.
Yeah.
I mean, I think our youngest has really been a college student. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to say the oldest, but the other has been another professional writer. Like the experience ranges from someone who has no experience to someone who has produced works. And the ages range the same way.
I mean, one of the things that works about having a writing circle is most people want deadlines, and you know, and so when you have the pressure of the next meeting and you've got to show some product, it just gives everybody a little bit of a little bit of motivation. So
yeah, we get motivated every day.
Yeah,
Another show starts at 11.
Right?
Tomorrow, Larry.
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
Yeah.
It's just like that.
Just like that.
Well, here we are. We got six plays, right? Coming?
Yeah, right now we have four running. Yep.
Four running now.
That's correct.
Six total for the season, right?
Six total for the season, and then we'll do a holiday show as well.
And tell us what you've got.
Well, this summer out at the park, we're running three shows in repertory. One of them is an old standard for us. It's celebrating its 30th anniversary. That's the one you saw last night, Larry, called Belgians in Heaven, which Doc was one of the co-creators of, and he can talk more about that show and the prequel to that show called Hell's Belgians, which Doc and his fellow writer Lee Becker had been working on for a while because they wanted to expand the you know, the storytelling of those characters. And then the third show that's running in rep is called The Fisherman's Daughters, written by Katie Dahl. And that is a really interesting play because it's about the founding of Peninsula State Park, and it's taking place in Peninsula State Park. So it's really appropriate, and it's a beautiful show. So I encourage anybody to go out to see all of the shows at the theater in the park. That's in Peninsula State Park, and we are Monday through Saturday with eight shows a week. So it's a full load. And then in this theater where we're sitting right now, just a couple of days ago, we opened another world premiere. We're doing four of them this year, called Girls on Sand, which LaCrissa mentioned. Yes. Thank you.
Sounds like a lot of people in the audience.
Yeah, well, we're sitting on the set, which is super fun. LaCrissa and Molly are the two writers of the book and lyrics for that show, and they also appear in it. So they have a personal stake in that material, which is always a lot of fun to see. And Alyssa Rohde was the composer on that piece. So that's our summer lineup so far.
So that's a lot.
with more to come. Yeah.
What's that process like for selecting plays and actually, I mean, this has got, I mean, they're all original.
Right. Well, the process.
It's not going to be, Doc's not going to say, well, next year I'll write a piece on this, a play on this, or will you?
Not anymore. we used to. That's how it went in the early years. two or three of us were writing all the shows, and we just cranked them out.
Yeah. Well, it sort of depends, Larry. Some people have a longer incubation process for their, you know, for their creative endeavors. But for Girls on Sand, we fast-tracked, and these guys really wrote that show in about a year. It was maybe a little bit more than that, but it was approximately a year to get that one up and going, which is very unusual, extremely unusual. It usually is a process of a series of readings and then a series of workshops, if not one or two, that allow for us to get closer to the material and make sure that it's all working. And in terms of how do you choose a season of original material, you use your premiere, the world premiere, as sort of your anchor, and then you program around it so that you can do as much cross casting as possible so that you're maximizing contracts and all that kind of good financial stuff.
Yeah, what's the size of the company?
Boy, that's a good question. We have roughly, I'd say, 40 to 50, maybe 60 by the time we get everybody all Ooh. Hired for the summer and fall and the crossover. Yeah.
And a lot of times people are involved in more than one play, even at the same time?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. LaCrissa has been out at the park and been in all three shows at one time, I think.
I have. A couple years ago, I did the rep. And, I mean, last year I did both shows, mm-hmm. Fish Whisperer and Cheeseheads.
Right, right.
And this season even, right now we're doing Girls on Sand, which is the only show running indoor right now, but in a short 2 weeks, we'll start rehearsals for Reality Trip, which is our fall world premiere, and I will be doing shows at night and rehearsing during the day mm-hmm. for that. So it keeps going. The train never stops.
Never stops.
Train never stops. And it never stops here at Wisconsin Public Radio either. Larry Mueller here with our guest today from the Northern Sky Theater Company, Jeff Herbst, who is the artistic director. Doc Heide is the artistic advisor, co-founder. LaCrissa Granberry, a performer, playwright, and NOVA program director. Questions for them? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Or if you're in our live audience, you can just raise your hand and ask your questions as well. Larry Mueller here for WPR News. Great. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with a live audience from the Northern Sky Theater in Fish Creek. It's great to have our three guests, Jeff Herbst, Doc Heide, and LaCrissa Granberry, talking about Northern Sky Theater and the plays and what goes on to put a production on. Questions for them? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. And we have a question from the audience. So let's go there.
Since so many of the plays have a Wisconsin or our local theme here, how many other times have those plays been performed, let's say, in New York or Washington? Do they get out around the country, or is it just here in Wisconsin that we love them?
We've had some of our productions play all over the country. Probably the one that's played the most that was homegrown here is Guys on Ice. That show has played, yeah. That show originated as a co-production between Northern Sky Theater and Milwaukee Repertory Theater, and it has since played in almost every state in the United States. And people, how many, I can tell that a lot of you have seen that show. It's very, the guys who are in it, the guys on ice who are in it, are huge Packer fans. And people always ask, well, how does that play in Texas, for instance? And I'm like, well, you know, everybody loves anybody who's obsessed about something, right? So I think they get it. They certainly appreciate the enthusiasm that the guys have for their homegrown team, that's for sure. We've had a lot of other productions, too. Of course, one of the things that we'd like to do is have more of our productions reach a larger audience. And one of the things that I've been working on, the pandemic sort of interrupted it, is an initiative called it's sort of the Non-Urban Theater Consortium. And the idea is that there are a lot of theater companies in this country, all over the place. You can go to Colorado, you know, in the summertime, and you can see theater that's very similar to what happens at Northern Sky, except they don't dedicate themselves to doing original musicals or original programming, but they're interested in it. And they know that their audiences could be interested in the same kind of material that we do. So I think there's a huge audience out there that just needs to get to know us. And because we're not published like in Samuel French, where you know you can just go pick out a play and pay the royalties, we have to find a way to make sure that our work gets seen, heard, and understood by other theater companies, and that it would be right for them.
Great question and great answer. Let's take another question from the audience.
I have actually a question and a comment. I'll ask the question first, and then I'll add my comment. I'm wondering, to the actors, how different it is preparing for the outdoor theater and inside, coming back and forth. There's got to be some differences, subtle and not so subtle. And secondly, my comment is 41 years ago, I performed of sorts on the theater in the park when I asked my wife to marry me there, and we got married.
I see you're sitting far apart from one another. That's not a
Oh, great. Thanks so much for that comment. Well, what about it?
I mean, sure, I'll start because this is my first summer season indoors instead of outdoors. And if you know me, you know that my answer is going to be the biggest difference is that there are no bugs inside. And I don't have to perform in the rain. And it's not cold one day and hot the next. But I will say, I do love performing indoors because of those things, but I do miss, the outdoors is just beautiful, and it's magical in a sense to look up and see the trees and the skies. I remember my very first year, we were in tech, and I liked to bullet journal, and I sat down, and I just found myself drawing the stage and the trees, and because there's something very soothing and magical about doing theater out there when a June bug isn't flying at your head.
Plus,
Jeff, go ahead.
LaCrissa doesn't get to perform with me this summer because I'm in the park and she's indoors and she misses me, you know, so much.
True.
Well, so what about the rain?
The rain?
You know, when it's raining on the outside, and people are there to watch.
Oh,
and they
for
got
sure.
They're not putting their umbrellas up because that'll block the person behind them.
Yeah. But well, Wisconsinites come prepared. You know, they almost everybody has rain gear, ponchos, hoods, whatever they need, and they do sit through the rain. I'll tell you, Larry, one of the most magical performances out there was when the rain just drizzled for the entire performance of a show called Victory Farm, which is set in World War II. It's about German POWs who were brought over to help do the cherry picking in the orchards. So it's a show that's got a lot of, you know, atmosphere anyway, but with that light drizzle of rain through the whole show, it just, you know, you can't manufacture that, right?
No, you can't. I want to turn to Doc here for a minute because, Doc, you are the co-author of Belgians in Heaven, which yes. was so much fun to watch last night. I laughed and the songs, great songs. How did that whole piece come about?
Well, Belgians was written about 30 years ago. I was teaching back then psychology out in California. I had a year sabbatical, so I had something to work on. I needed something to work on. My mother actually had gotten cancer, and so I was thinking a lot about mortality and the meaning of life. That was kind of in the background of my mind. And then one of the co-founders of the theater, Fred Alley, who Jeff mentioned, he was over at my house one morning in the spring of 93, and we had a little tiff. We got along really good. We were best friends, but that day he was irritated with me, and I went for a jog in the Berkeley Hills, and I had the thought, what if Fred and I had actually been reincarnated through eternity to learn to work out our differences together? So this thing, on the surface, it seemed like we were arguing, but maybe there was a deeper level in which we were sort of destined to learn to grow, to be closer, you know, as friends. And I thought, that's an interesting idea for a musical.
This is not the kind of idea that would come through my mind.
Right. And, you know, by the time I got done with my jog, I came home and wrote out most of the plot. I thought there should be a guardian angel. That would be interesting. And I thought it would be fun to write a role for Jeff as he plays the role of Henry, who is our handyman, who seems very simple on the surface, but turns out to be extremely deep. So I had the great advantage of writing the characters for people I knew, like Karen Moll, for example. I has an angelic quality in real life, so I wrote a character of the angel for her. And I saw the whole thing as just kind of a writing exercise. I'd never written a book musical before. So I thought, well, this would be an interesting challenge. And I just was shocked. I think we were all a little taken aback by the enormous response the show generated almost immediately. Hundreds of people were coming out. People came out in electrical storms. They were standing lined up, 200 people, you know, as lightning was in the sky because they wanted to see the show. And one night I was approached by a woman after the show, and she said, I have terminal cancer, and I've been afraid of dying, but after seeing your show, I feel like I can pass on in peace. You know, wow. So there, you know, that's the kind of thing that you live for as a playwright, to have that kind of impact. So we were just delighted that the show had such an enormous impact.
And some great dad jokes to start the show, like,
right?
Kind of early on.
Yeah, there's a joke at the top of that show that I'd always loved, and I thought, you know, a great way to start the thing off would be to have a joke that is corny, so it will work either way. If people think it's funny, they'll laugh along, and if they don't think it's funny, they'll think it's funny that the character who's telling it thinks it's funny. So it works on multiple levels. And
the songs. Did you write the songs? I mean, the songs are great.
Thank you.
Songs.
Yeah.
And of course they're well performed, that which helps.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, I wrote all the lyrics initially. I asked my friend Lee Becker to join us for a rewrite in 2006 or something, and he and I wrote one new song, and then Jimmy Kaplan wrote half the music. He and I were friends, and I asked him to join me in writing half the music. The most famous song in that show is Cheese Curds, Booyah, and Beer. A lot of people know that. I actually wrote that on a walk through Peninsula State Park, about a half an hour. It just came to me. and asked Jimmy to write a kind of a polka melody for it, and it turned out to be a big hit.
Yeah, cheese, booyah, and beer.
Yes.
And the I could tell that you have done that song together many times because yes. The choreography right. and so forth is just like perfect for right. every song.
That's become the song that maybe more than any song we've ever done in our theater history, people know and they will sing along at campfires and so on.
People were requesting t-shirts last night with cheese curds, booyah, and beer on it.
And we have them, by the way.
You yeah. do have them? Yeah.
We are selling t-shirts
see that
say cheese curds, booyah, and beer. In fact, we also have a beer this year.
Yes.
We produced our own beer, our Peach Barn Brewer did, so to honor the show.
Well, it was an absolute treat. And I would go back and see it, and I bet people see that more than once.
They do.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We did a survey a few years ago, and we found that one out of every three people in the audience had seen the show before. They were coming back. And some people had seen it six times, eight times. There was one person that night who had seen it 20 times. So, yeah.
We back in the day, we made cassette tapes of the shows, you know, and yeah. Sold them. And it's not infrequent when we have someone come up and say, I wore out the tape. Is there going to be a CD or is it going to stream, you know?
Right.
Well, now you can still get it, though. You know, it's up to date these days. It's not on a tape, but it is.
I don't know. Do we have Belgians in Heaven in any other form? I maybe we do.
I don't think
we
so.
We have other albums, though.
Oh, we have a Sunflower.
Oh, yeah, we do have Sunflower, but yeah. we have an entire Apple Music page
yeah,
that
do.
Is Northern Sky.
That's true, LaCrissa.
You can find all of our streaming music, and this season, all four world premieres will have live cast albums.
That's right.
So you can still follow along in different formats, or you can buy the CD.
Ooh.
Yeah.
there you go. You know, the whole business about funding, I mean, we're sitting in the Gould Theater, Barb and Spencer Gould mm-hmm. were the lead donors for this, but raising money and Barb still here, mm-hmm. still very active mm-hmm. person in this, but it takes a lot of people, and you can't rely solely, I don't imagine, on theater tickets to...
No, that's right, Larry. You know, like most not-for-profits, especially artistic theater companies, you rely heavily on a donor base. You try to make that ratio be reasonable, and but there's no question that in order for us to do this, we count heavily on our donors, and they've been unbelievable. We had to shut down. We had to shut down when the pandemic came. Literally shut down.
Yeah.
And we quickly, as the word is, pivoted and did an extremely fun and I think really effective online season all of 2020. We generated more content. We were sort of like you know, like every day we were trying to come up with something that kept people engaged. And I think it helped immensely. It made people feel like they were still connected to us. And when we came back from the pandemic, people were like, we loved having your presence during, you know, that shutdown. So we were awfully grateful for our donors keeping us alive and for our doors having been shuttered, but not our creativity and certainly not our output.
Some emails, let's see, we had, someone wondered about Girls on Sand as a follow-up to your Guys on Ice, and that's, that the way it is there, it LaCrissa?
It is certainly inspired by Guys on Ice, following the same sort of format of these two friends in a place living and being existing. And so it is inspired by Guys on Ice, but it is not any sort of direct connection to it. However, it's a very fun show. If you've seen it already, you know that. It is a story of women friendship bonds and aging and health and goose poop and it's a lot of cahoots happening in that show. Took
set
a page
here.
Out of your book, jokes, whether you groan at them or laugh at them. Mm-hmm.
And set here.
And it's here.
Set here.
It's sat here.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's basically set on the Door County Beach.
Oh, yes. Thank you. I was like, yeah, it's here. No. It is. I co-wrote the show with Molly Rohde, who I think we have that, well, we get the benefit of having a true friendship in real life and playing best friends on stage, but we also happen to go to Ephraim Beach a lot and live our best lives. Yeah.
Perfect. Well, let's take a question from the, or comment from the audience.
I just wanted to say I have a comment and a question. And my comment is, I cannot wait to see Girls on Sand. When I read that your whole premise is, or your beach rule is avoiding negativity. And I just feel like there's a miasma of negativity that can shroud us lately. And so I'm hoping to get some tips on that. But also, I'm wondering what inspired you to choose that surrounding the beach rule.
Oh, that's such a great question. Thank you for asking that. So as sort of a debrief after the day, because life be lifin', as someone once said, Rohde and I, Molly Rohde, after a show sometimes we would go to Ephraim Beach at night and we would play a song and we would dance. This is legit.
No, I know. I don't doubt you, Larissa.
We would play a song and we would dance and then we would find reasons to be grateful in spite of the day that is happening, in spite of the week that is happening, and share what are we grateful for today and hold on to sort of that. So the story has a lot about gratitude in it as well. You talk about no negativity. How do you negate negativity? You find reasons to be grateful. You choose joy instead. You choose happiness. You choose fun. And we did a lot of that, and a lot of that you'll see in the show. So that's how that came to be.
A great, great comment. Thank you so much for that comment and question. And let's take another, we have another question from the audience.
Yes, I have a comment and a question again. The comment is, we did see your opening performance the other night, and it was wonderfully done. Great story, really enjoyed it. I highly recommend it to everybody. And the question is, what's your process of going about selecting these actors?
Selecting the actors. You know, primarily what I have done as an artistic director for my now 34 years or whatever it's been, I like to work with the same people if they're available. And I believe strongly in because we can't have a year-round company, I want people to still feel like they have a seasonal company and that when they go away from here, they still feel connected. That's part of the reason I wanted to get Nova initiated, was to make sure that people could get buy-in to what the Northern Sky ethos is, and also what our work habits are. But primarily, we started as a company that was, like Doc said, was writing roles for one another. And that is also something that continues. People will still say, oh, I have this idea in mind, and obviously Doug Manchesky is going to play that role. So it's sort of, you know, it feeds off one another, really, in a lot of ways. Now, there are times when you have to go outside of the core company, as it were, to find somebody specific for a role, and then you bring somebody new in, which is also great because, you know, why not? And they add another voice. But primarily, frankly, over the course of this company's life, it's been a lot of people who have just come back year after year after year, for which I am eternally grateful, because I love having them back, and I love that people are writing roles for them.
Thank you so much for that question. Megan in Madison emailed to say they love the shows by Northern Sky Theater. Megan grew up watching the shows at Peninsula State Park while camping there every year, which I did as well. And Megan is excited Lumberjacks in Love will be playing in Milwaukee this winter. Could you kind of comment on that?
Yeah, Milwaukee Rep is bringing back Lumberjacks in Love. We did a production of it, Fred Alley, who was then still alive, in 2000. He and Jimmy kind of went back to the drawing boards, and they expanded the show some. They added a bunch of new material, and we first presented it down at Milwaukee Rep for a run there, and then brought it up to the park for the summer of 2000. Since then, we've done it a number of times, and it's come back around now to the Milwaukee rep wanting to do it down there. So it's going to be there, I think, for a three-month run, which is really terrific.
Which is great. Jeff Herbst, Doc Heidi, and LaCrissa Granberry, our guests today from Northern Sky Theater. I'm Larry Mueller. You can join in, too, with your questions. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or like some others have done, you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We are broadcasting from the Northern Sky Theater in Fish Creek today with three guests. I'm Larry Mueller, by the way. Our guest, Jeff Herbst, Artistic Director of Northern Sky Theater. Doc Heidi is the artistic advisor and co-founder and playwright, and LaCrissa Granberry, a performer, playwright, and NOVA program director, and NOVA stands for Networking Original Voices, or Nurturing Original Voices and Artists. Great to have them along. Questions for them? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Doc, could you talk a little more about Hell's Belgians, which is actually a prequel?
Yes, it is. So right out of the gate, when we wrote Belgians in Heaven, as I was saying, it turned out to be this big hit. So people started saying, you should write a sequel to that. And it seemed logical, if you were going to write a sequel to a show called Belgians in Heaven, people said, well, you should write Belgians in Hell. And I was much more interested in heaven than I was in hell, I must say. My mother was a very devout person, and I was raised in a very, you know, devout household. And so I was much more interested in reading and learning about heaven than in hell. But we decided, well, we should go with, you know, explore that hell theme. What we decided to do after quite a few years of working, we've actually been working on it for 15 years now, we decided we would do a prequel rather than a sequel, because you know, Larry, having seen Belgians in Heaven last night, the plot gets a little complicated, and we didn't want to try to explain the plot of Belgians in Heaven in a sequel, because even the people in the show don't really understand it. It involves some really interesting ideas you just have to kind of float along with. And so we thought a prequel will be easier to write. We'll explain where these characters come from, and people who have seen Belgians in Heaven know, for example, there's a prominent character called Mildred the Chicken, and we thought, well, we can explain where Mildred the Chicken comes from. We also have this darling angel, Angelique, in the original show, and we finally decided to center the show on her and explain how she got into the Guardian Corps of Angels. And so even though the show is called Hell's Belgians, the centerpiece of the show is about how this angel gets her guardian wings. So we just wanted to take this opportunity to say, for any of you out there who are afraid of bringing your small children to a show that has hell in the title, it's not scary at all. Hell is only a small part of it. It really is focused on how the two brothers become closer and how this angel gets her wings and stuff like that.
Well, and I'm going to switch back to Belgians in Heaven for just a minute, because mm-hmm. when you mentioned chickens,
yes.
I was reminded of and it took me a second while I was watching, the chicken is clucking.
Yes.
And clucking in kind of cool ways.
Right.
And then I finally looked over sort of on the right side
right.
of
yes.
the, sort of off, almost off the set or offset.
Mm-hmm.
Is a guy over there doing that.
Right, there is.
And not just the chicken noises, but...
No!
No, I mean, all kinds of sound effects, and seagulls, and Lee Becker is one of the co-writers of that show. I always say to Lee, I couldn't do what Lee does over there.
No.
It's amazing.
It's brilliant.
It's amazing what he does with his voice.
Yeah, that's a convention we actually learned from the great Paul Sills, Larry. many people might know, Paul Sills was the founding director of the Second City in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And we were very privileged to be able to work with him for many years. His mother, Viola Spolin, basically invented improvisational acting in America. And he taught it to Alan Arkin and Alan Alda and, you know, Valerie Harper and all these, you know, famous people, Mike Nichols, Elaine May. And he taught it to us. And one of the things he did in a show on Broadway was to have a character like that that's invisible, but is voiced by someone else on a microphone on the side of the stage. And I remember Paul telling me one time that he was able to get that show funded because a producer came to a preview and they were interacting with some invisible object, and he said, "I saw the object," you know, even though it wasn't there, but the actors convincingly portrayed an invisible object on stage, and then he came up with the money to put the show on Broadway. So I needed an antagonist in Belgians in Heaven, someone, I don't want to give away too much of the plot, but my character, Roger, ends up having a near-death experience in the show, and I needed someone to kill him, basically. And I thought, wouldn't it be fun to have a chicken do it?
An invisible chicken.
Yes, exactly. I was actually driving and listening to Wisconsin Public Radio, and the Garrison Keillor show came on, and he had some chicken character, you know, on the show that night, and I thought, that's a really funny animal character. So we came up with Mildred the Chicken, and people love him.
And how that worked on the stage was absolutely great.
Yes.
The chicken killing you.
Thank you, yes. He does an outstanding job of killing me, and that's how I end up in heaven, yes.
And Lee Becker came up through the Comedy Sports in Madison, I believe, that improv group.
He did.
As a matter of fact.
And he's a fellow Mount Horbite, too. Mount Horb, Wisconsin. Lee and I are both from Mount Horb, and so is Fred Alley. We have a little contingency. Dan Clare, too, who's also been with the company a long time. He's currently, I think, performing at Third Avenue Playhouse. Mm-hmm. There are a mess of us who...
I've got an email here, which I'm trying to get to. Oh, Kimberly emailed. He took a trip to Door County. It's a little story. A few years back when their children were 10 and 5, they went to the drive-in theater on the first night, which the kids loved and wanted to go back again. But their mom and dad had previously seen performances of Lumberjacks in Love and Guys on Ice, mm-hmm, and thought they were the funniest shows ever. The kids didn't want to go to some theater show, but they did, and they loved the experience, and they went back for more.
Yes, and that happens all the time. On any given night, there will be people in the audience who first came when they were children, and they are now coming as grandparents, bringing their kids and their grandkids to the show. We make all of our shows accessible for the entire family so that kids can come. And a show like Belgians in Heaven, for example, somebody reported to me they saw the little kids standing at a picnic table singing cheese curds, booyah, and beer, you know? So there's some enlightened metaphysical themes in the show, but they also appeal to four-year-olds.
Well, and I should mention that Joel Patnaud, one of our producers, is from Mount Horeb.
Oh.
As well. He's ensconced in an office somewhere here and taking calls as they come in. Wow. And you can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Before we take a call, LaCrissa, you're a playwright. How do you approach the process of creating a play? I mean, you told us a little about your experience, but... talk a bit more about that whole process.
Oh, boy, that's a loaded question. How do I approach the process of a play? Well, I'll tell you about this one. I think working here and being a part of Northern Sky, there is, it's its own place and culture. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like whenever I write for Northern Sky and want to write for our audiences, even Girls on Sand, it was... I don't know, in part, wanting to give people something that they can enjoy and something that made their hearts feel all fuzzy, and something that had characters that you wouldn't forget or moments that you wouldn't forget. And so I take a good observation around for who I'm writing for. That's really the first thing I do.
Yeah, Jeff too?
Well, I'm not a writer, but certainly I encourage my writers to draw on stuff that is dear to them. I think that's the best way to write, you know, is to write something that you're passionate about, so that if it comes from them, I feel way more confident that it's going to happen than if I tell them what to write.
It's a true story, because you gave that advice to Writing Circle. Jeff came and met with our Writing Circle team this year, who was participating in the Nova Circle, and one of your pieces of advice was write from the heart. Write what's true to you, then it'll be good.
Somebody else is wanting to know, what is the most difficult situation you've been in on stage? And that could be, I'm not sure. I mean, I can think of all kinds of things that might happen.
I'll tell you, last night is the most present one in my mind. So Girls on Sand is a three-person show. There are three characters. However, two of us are on stage for about 90% of that show. Yeah. And we were about, I don't know, maybe two songs in, and I started to have a cough attack. And the kind where you lose your voice and tears are falling down your eyes. And I was like, oh my goodness, I have three or four more songs to sing before I can get off stage. And my dear scene partner said, drink some water. And I said, I am.
Yeah.
But that was, I feel like, one of my most ridiculous moments this season so far is I didn't know if I was going to recover. And then I had to get up and eat chips after that.
You know, yeah, go ahead.
Well, we have a lot of experiences out at the park. You know, over the years, we've had all kinds of disturbances and disruptions and planes flying over. And there are just times when you can't ignore it. Mm-hmm. So you just stop and you take it in. And the audience goes with you on any of those mishaps, as they were. I think that's part of the charm of live theater.
One time during Belgians, I remember it was raining, and I think Fred or you looked up and said, we really need to fix that hole in the roof.
Yeah. Well, who was telling me last night? Kelly Doherty, who's in Fisherman's Daughters, they performed the other night in the rain for the whole show, like I was describing with 50 Farm. And there was a night when it was extremely windy, and Katie Dahl, who wrote that show, the stage manager, Sean Galligan, counted up. There are 42 mentions of wind in that show, so the audience was with it, believe me.
And I can even remember one from last night.
Yes.
Tell that one, because that got a big laugh, actually. The way you handled it, Doc, was great.
Well, Kelly Doherty, who's playing the pre-incarnate version of the woman I'm in love with, and don't ask what that means. Anyway, I'm having a conversation with her in heaven, and she couldn't speak, and she ended up saying something about having a frog in her throat.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I said, I guess there's actually frogs in heaven. And then Becker began going ribbit on the mic.
Oh, that's good. So I saw Ryan sneak over from the orchestra pit with some water for Kelly during the scene.
At first I wondered if that was part of the scene, and then I saw somebody sneaking over with water for her. Because I knew she was probably going to have to sing again, too.
Right,
and,
yes.
And so exactly. I can understand that well. Well, you folks do a wonderful job.
Oh, thanks, Larry.
Thank you.
It was great to attend. I'll be attending many more down the road, and I want to thank the three of you for being with us today. It's
thank
been
you.
A great pleasure.
Oh, good.
Mm-hmm. And we'll do this again.
Good.
Thank you so much. Jeff Herbst, artistic director. Doc Heidi, artistic advisor, co-founder. LaCrissa Granberry, performer, playwright, and Nova program director. Our guests to start the show. And coming up, we're going to be talking about the Wisconsin Maritime Museum, a bit about history and a bit about shipwrecks. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us here on WBR News. Larry Mueller here. We're at Fish Creek, Wisconsin, at the wonderful Northern Sky Theater. And we are talking, we're going to switch gears. We talked about the theater a little bit. Now we're going to take a look at our maritime history a bit with a couple of people from the Door County Maritime Museum. We're going to talk about what's going on at the museum. It almost feels like three museums. So we'll get into that. And we will probably get into shipwrecks a little bit, and certainly we'll invite you to call in with your questions and comments as we move along today. We've got a museum question, a maritime museum question. Maybe you have a question about shipwrecks. These guys know all about it. Kevin Osgood is the executive director at the Door County Maritime Museum. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
Great to have you with us. And Sam Perlman, Sam's deputy director and development manager at the museum. And Sam, welcome to you. Thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you so much for having us, and great to have you here in Door County.
Well, I tell you what, it's great to be here. And I'm hoping we have lots of questions. We'll talk about all kinds of topics as we move along with our guests today. And again, join in 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Kevin, first let's talk about the mission of the Door County Maritime Museum.
Well, it's really boils down to preserving and conveying the history, our maritime history in Door County. We look at Door County that there's really one history here. It's all connected to the water. Everyone comes here for water. Everything that started here was because of the land and the water being so close. So our county's history is truly a maritime history, and preserving that, because it's gone back hundreds of years, is a fantastic mission and just a wonderful, wonderful way to have the job of a lifetime.
And if I'm not mistaken, the Maritime Museum, the Door County Maritime Museum, works in concert a bit with the Lighthouse Preservation Society.
That is our official name. We are the Door County Maritime Museum and Lighthouse Preservation Society Incorporated. Is a long name.
That's a long name.
But the organization wanted to position itself to really be here to take care of the treasures that we have in the county. And it started in 1969 with a group of local fishermen up at the tip of the peninsula in Gills Rock area. And they were noticing a lot of the folks here on vacation scuba diving in the 60s and bringing up all these artifacts from schooners and plopping them in the trunk of the car and heading off somewhere else. This was before it was illegal to do that. And they got together and started the Door County Maritime Museum at Gills Rock, which is now called the Death's Door Maritime Museum. And that was a way to keep the artifacts here.
And there are three ports of call now, so to speak.
Exactly. We like to say it's one history, three ports of call. So we do have three museum locations. As Kevin said, our organization started in 1969 at the tip of the peninsula, at the Death's Door Maritime Museum up in Gills Rock. We have our main museum in Sturgeon Bay, the Door County Maritime Museum, and that's on the working waterfront of Sturgeon Bay between the two downtown bridges. And then we also operate and manage the Cana Island Lighthouse in Bailey's Harbor on behalf of the County of Door and the County Parks Department.
Yeah, that Cana Lighthouse. I wonder how many photos I've taken of that myself.
I hadn't thought about that question. I know I've taken a lot.
I would say that in our digital archives, there are
thousands
of photographs. It's probably one of the most photographed icons in Door County and in the state of Wisconsin. And folks are kind enough to share those photographs with us. So, and we keep them all, so keep them coming. Keep sending us info@dcmm.org. You can email those photos to us, post them to our Facebook page. We keep them, but yes, we have thousands and thousands of images of Cana Island.
So let's talk about Death's Door for a minute. What can visitors expect to see at Death's Door?
Well, there's a brand new exhibit this year about the tangled net of Door County, Northern Door's fishing families, and that tracks down some of the very well-known names who have been fishing for multiple generations here. And it's still a vibrant industry, especially in Northern Door. We have two commercial fishermen serving on the board of directors, and there's some really interesting and magical stories with some of the families, and I don't believe they're all. We haven't included all the families that do it, but I'm familiar with some of them, and one story in particular is told at the Sturgeon Bay Museum. We can talk about that later. I don't want to get messed up, but it mainly focuses on shipwrecks and commercial fishing at the Death's Door Maritime Museum.
So, and that's the origins of the name Door County. That passage between the tip of the peninsula and Washington Island was known by the French first in their navigation charts as Port de Mort, Death's Door. And I guess that calling it Death County would probably not be a good marketing angle. So Door County was the way they went.
Although I think the French did that probably to keep the British away.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely.
Well, there's more than one ship that went down in that spot.
Well, there's close to, 275 to 300 shipwrecks in the 300 miles of shoreline of Door County. And each of those has an incredible story. Clearly, we had to study up on some, but the people affected by that, not only building the ships and the storms that took them out and where they rest now and where can you see artifacts from them. We get phone calls still today after a major storm. Some artifact will wash up on a beach and someone wants to know what to do with it. And first thing we do is explain the state statute about don't mess with it, and we'll let the state know it's there.
Oh, and so you guys don't go pick it up. It's
if they're going to throw it away or turn it into a picnic table, we'll go out there and get it. But we will get in touch with the State Historical Society and make sure we coordinate what happens.
What would be an example of something that somebody might just find?
Well, we recently had a phone call about a rudder, and I said, well, how big of a rudder? And they said, well, it took me and a couple of friends a day with a front-end loader to lift it up the ledge from the beach. And when our curator got down there, this thing, I think, was 12 feet long and 8 feet wide. So it was a pretty significant schooner rudder, and there was a shipwreck just off the beach there from where that was. So
And you knew the ship, probably.
Knew the ship. There couldn't be 100% sure, right. But a good idea where it came from.
A good idea. Oh, my goodness. Questions for our guests? We have some calls coming in. Love to take those calls. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. I'm not sure if Tom is up or not for a phone call.
Yep. Hey, Larry, and thanks a lot for taking my call. I swear that the Great Lakes maritime history is almost a hidden history. I grew up in Chicago and had no idea that Chicago was the fourth busiest sailing port in the whole Western world during the 1880s. I started sailing on schooners in Chicago and in Milwaukee. I was one of the relief captains on the Dennis Sullivan in Milwaukee. And I've just been into the history forever. And wherever you go, there's, even if you don't live near Door County, there are fantastic maritime museums in Chicago, in South Haven, in Manitowoc, of course, and then Door County is one of the most beautiful ones. So take advantage of it. Google maritime Great Lakes history and just enjoy the stories.
Let me thank him for calling.
Yeah, you're hired.
Tom, obviously, thank you. But just a comment.
It's a great comment, and a lot of it's these little stories that people don't realize. We know there are quarries here, that the limestone here was one of the reasons that brought a lot of the ships here to they got that limestone out and had to bring it somewhere. Well, where did most of it go? To the waterfronts of major cities on the Great Lakes. A lot of that stone that kept Chicago safe for years and years came right here from Door County, and it was moved down there on schooners and steamers to do that. So
that's a pretty cool story.
The lumber that built the cities around the Great Lakes, and certainly Chicago and Milwaukee, like Kevin said, the limestone that lines all of the shorelines in those cities, all of that came from Door County. You know, those are stories that we talk about at the museum. The industries in Door County, Wisconsin, that have had a global impact over history. The ice that kept food cold in the ice boxes of Milwaukee and Chicago was cut out of the Bay of Green Bay here in Door County, packed in sawdust, and shipped down to Chicago and Milwaukee for food preservation.
Or air conditioning.
Or air conditioning as well. Well, let's take another call. Anne, we'll go to you now. Anne, thank you for calling.
Hello, Larry, and your guests. It's very nice to talk to you.
you're right.
I have toured the tugboat that's off of the dock of the Sturgeon Bay location. Is that the Purvis? I'm trying to remember the name of the tug.
It is, the John Purvis.
There you go. And on the tour guide told us about the terrible job of cleaning up the inside bottom of the tug. There was all kinds of oil and dropped tools in there, and it was such a terrible job to clean out. And the tools that they found were shown in a display there. And a child said to the tour guide, "Well, that tool isn't so old." And the tour guide said, "Well, how do you know that?" And the child said, "Well, it says made in China on it."
That is true. I think I know which tour guide you might have had. The John Purvis is a lot of people, even here in Door County, I'm shocked by the number of people who have never been aboard the boat. The story of the John Purvis is, well, number one, it's a 105-year-old tugboat. The United States government built it in World War I, thinking it was going to be part of the war effort, and it was built in Elizabeth, New Jersey, and launched to be an ocean-going tug, and it was launched in 1919. There hadn't been an armistice signed yet, but the war was over, so she went to work for the Bureau of Shipping in Bermuda, and we just had a connection with a Bermuda historian who sent us links to all sorts of newspaper articles about her history there. But later on in life, as she got to the Great Lakes, well, first off, built by the U.S. government, right? 2 years later, yeah. They sold her as surplus. And that's how she got to the Great Lakes. A tug company in Milwaukee bought her up and brought her up here. And in 1941, with the little attack on Pearl Harbor, the Army repossessed the tugboat John Purvis. And we recently received a donation of a photo album from the grandchildren of a U.S. Army soldier who was stationed aboard the tugboat in Duluth, Minnesota. I can imagine what he looked like Errol Flynn. There's pictures of him in the album. And Goosebumps telling the story, and I'm sorry, Sam knows I love this story. But he drew a hand-drawn map. So they repainted the tug. It was redesignated LT-145 for Light Tug 145. And they left Duluth and sailed all the way to their new wartime home port of Seattle, Washington, on that tugboat. Her wartime duties during World War II were to tow barges of ammunition and food supplies to the U.S. military garrisons on the Aleutian Islands that were keeping the Japanese out of North America. Anyone ever watched that little Bering Sea fishing story on television and knows what that North Pacific and the Bering Sea is like for waves? That little tugboat at 149 feet long, tied up behind our maritime museum, was towing high explosives and food during the war years, and then came back to Sturgeon Bay. She ended up a part of the Rowan shipping family, and she was converted to diesel, and she just has so many stories of the people that served. A caller talked about one. That was the chief engineer and multiple other engineers. When they drop a tool in that bilge filled with oil and water and whatever else, they left it there. And when she was just in dry dock a few months ago, and we saw some interesting things in there when they cleaned it out again. Some of them too big for any human being to lift out, and just leave them there. We'll get at it next time she's in charge.
You got more help when you have more help. Oh, man. Sam Perlman, Deputy Director and Development Manager at the Door County Maritime Museum. Kevin Osgood is the Executive Director at the Door County Maritime Museum. Talking with them about it, you can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for being with us today here on WPR News as we broadcast from Sister Bay. It's great to be here with a lovely live audience and to have you listening over the radio or maybe on your app or however you do it these days. It's great to have you along. We're talking with Sam Perlman and Kevin Osgood of the Door County Maritime Museum. We've talked about what's going on with the museum, a few things. We haven't gotten to everything yet for sure. A bit about shipwrecks. Questions for us, you can join in. Number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. And among our live audience members, if you have a question, please feel free, raise your hand, and Jill Nadeau will be there with the microphone. There we go. Let's take a call from Dennis from Two Rivers. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Larry. I would think that when they mentioned that big rudder, I've been in the Navy, but I've never been on a schooner, but I would figure they need to coordinate the rudder with the sails because they need to sail with the sails also, and if they don't coordinate, well, they're going to have a cracked ship. And I have a story about the origin of that invisible chicken to go along with this with a sinking ship.
Well, the invisible chicken has disappeared. I saw it earlier, but now it's gone. But what about rudders?
Rudders do have to be used in coordination with the sails, and that's part of the allure of Death's Door or Port D'Amour. We talk to captains who sail those waters every day. In fact, the Shipwrecks documentary that PBS Wisconsin did had a great interview with a local captain that talked about how oftentimes up there, the wind will be blowing one direction and the water will be moving the other, and even faster. So if it's a low pressure system like we get in the fall, and you could have the wind at your back coming into the Bay of Green Bay, but the water rushing against you, so a schooner would have a hard time making any progress against that and would probably founder and move to the side and hit the rocks, which is a big reason why that happened a lot. It's just schooners don't do well at Death's Door. and this is a good opportunity to our friends that were in the first hour from Northern Sky really helped us out by creating an earworm back during COVID.
Indeed. So when they were shut down during the pandemic, they wanted to do something for their supporters because they couldn't perform. They didn't have a program with playbill ads or anything like that. So they conspired to write little jingles for all of their supporters with accompanying videos. And the one they did for us is absolutely spectacular. It is
schooners and tugboats and ships from World War II.
Lighthouses and shipwrecks, boy, you'll learn a thing or two about the fascinating history of our storied inland seas.
At the Maritime Museum
of Door County.
Oh. All right, I'll give you a hand for that one.
So I encourage you to go to YouTube and search Northern Sky DCMM. It's a bit of an earworm. Once you hear it, you can't get rid of it. But it is an absolutely delightful piece of original sea shanty material that Northern Sky did graciously for Door County Maritime Museum. And we have a great partnership with them. So.
Oh, man, that's great.
Thank you.
Sarah in Madison emailed to say they visited the Death's Door Maritime Museum in Ellison Bay this past week. The exhibits include history of some of the Door County fishing families, which you kind of mentioned, along with the Hope, a boat that actually you can actually step into and explore. Visitors can also watch the documentary footage of the fishing boat's last voyage in 1992. You want to talk about
that? That is the Hope. It is a very traditional Great Lakes fishing boat, and it's a wooden one with a Kahlenberg engine in it. And yes, you can step aboard. It's not handicapped accessible, but you can step up. If you can step aboard, you can go aboard, and everything is. You couldn't put it in the water today. It's been inside too long now, but it could be. They could fish on it. All the equipment is still there. Some of the things they dropped in the engine compartment are still there, although the oil is not. But she's got such a story tied to those families and the community in Northern Door and Gills Rock and Death's Door area. And yes, there's a video on her at that museum. There's also a video where you can listen to the last calls between the Edmund Fitzgerald and the other ships that night. It's a very, ooh, that just kicks off the shipwreck there. It's not a Door County shipwreck, but a lot of visitors come to our museum, and that's one of the things they want to know a little more about, mm-hmm. So we have a little bit of it there.
I wanted to say that's great. The experience wasn't great, but Being able to hear that has to be a wonderful experience. Well, can you talk more about what people will see when they go to the Jim Kress Lighthouse Tower.
So that is the 10-story addition to our museum in Sturgeon Bay that was built during the pandemic. We were in construction in 2020, open to the public in 21, and now is fully open. All 10 floors of the exhibits are 100% complete, and it really tries to tell in a fairly comprehensive way the story of Door County's maritime history. As Kevin talked about when we opened, we like to say that Door County is defined by water. It was a peninsula that was carved by the last ice age. So water, you know, ice and water are the same things. So it was carved out by the ice. And it is surrounded by water now. And water is the reason why and how people have come to this peninsula from the beginning of populations in this area. So 10,000 plus years of population, and it was all because of and by water.
And it's an interesting, it's a different museum experience. People said, is this just an observation tower? No. The 10 floors of the Jim Crest Maritime Lighthouse Tower is truly one exhibit on the complete maritime history of Door County from the very beginnings of when it was carved out by the glaciers all the way through to today. And each chapter of that is told on each floor. So it's a unique experience. There aren't many museums on this planet that tell the story vertically that way.
And the experience begins first floor in a theater. And then you take the elevator up to the top. We have an outdoor observation deck that is open seasonally when the weather's nice. And then you begin to descend one floor at a time, and really you're from the looking out over the working waterfront, and then we start with the geologic origins, navigation, exploration, the people of the water. We talked about commerce and the industries, all the way down to what lies below, what lies beneath, and that's, of course, shipwrecks.
And we're really proud of some of all the exhibits, but specifically on floor 8, the people of the water. About 75% of that floor is about the indigenous people who are here, Native Americans. And the only sound you hear on that floor are various native languages that were spoken here. So when you step into that floor, if you're talking and then you'll hear something and people stop, because one of my favorite things to do is to take this name badge off and just listen and kind of, I don't know, some people probably think I'm lurking a little too weirdly, but just follow through the museum and see what people engage with and see what their experience is like. And that's one where people stop and they kind of tilt their head like my dog does, and they say, what is that? And then they go over and start to explore the different tribes that were here and what they were here for, and that's what it's about. It's about engaging and getting people to hear it. And then my favorite phrase to hear from a guest is, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and I you answered my next question, which was going to be, for those people who, other able people, getting up all those stories and so forth, there's... the elevator.
There's a very nice elevator that works, right?
Right. We talked about Cana Island and all of the lighthouses that surround the peninsula. Those were built in the 1880s. Obviously, there was no thought towards accessibility. Yeah. The Jim Crest Maritime Lighthouse Tower does allow for a lighthouse-like experience for those who are not able to climb, say, the 97 spiral staircase steps to the top of the Cana Island Lighthouse. You are now up at the top of the tallest building in Door County, and you can see all the way out into the Bay of Green Bay, all the way to the canal and the working waterfront of Sturgeon Bay.
Yeah, and that's, I think it's the tallest building in two counties at least.
It is indeed, and the fifth tallest structure in Northeast Wisconsin.
Okay.
But the tallest one you can get to the top of and look out from. I don't think the Packers would let you climb to the top of the Jumbotron.
Although that would be kind of cool.
We've got a question from the audience, the live audience. Hi.
Hi. My grandfather, my mother's father, was a commercial fisherman on the Great Lakes. They went from Racine up to Grand Marais on Lake Superior for the whole summer. And then the family would go home, and I think they had a car unless it was a train. And then he came back later, and on his last run before winter, he was in a storm and the ship went down. But it was into Lake Michigan. So I was wondering if I wanted to research that a bit. My mother was only 12, so she doesn't have a lot of info. And so she was orphaned in the Depression, so that was sad. But anyways, would I start with the Manitowoc Maritime, do you think?
I would start actually with the state of Wisconsin's shipwrecks online database, which is wisconsinshipwrecks.org, and see if it's listed there. If not, then you can contact our curatorial department at the museum, and we may or may not have some information on that vessel as well.
All right. Thank you very much for, I'm sorry for the story, but thank you so much for your question. Others may have had a similar question. And we have a question from the audience. Let's go there.
I would just like to know, because Lake Superior has Edmund Fitzgerald, what is the most famous shipwreck of Lake Michigan?
The Griffin.
If we could find it.
Right.
Well, talk about the Griffin.
The Griffin, that has been found multiple times, and each time it's turned out not to be the Griffin, Le Griffon. I don't know. There's so many, and I just in preparation for this, we tried to... You know, I run the organization. I don't know everything about every shipwreck, but I was reading some things, and a line caught me on the state shipwrecks website that there are more shipwrecks in Lake Michigan than any other Great Lake. And that speaks volumes about how quickly the weather can change. And one of the exhibits we had in the museum in Sturgeon Bay that we, a couple years ago, moved up to Death's Door Maritime Museum is a map of the peninsula showing where many of the well-known wrecks are. And each of the wrecks has a date for when the ship went down. And Sam, I think, was the one who mentioned it first. He saw all these September, October, November, September, October, when the gales of November come early. And you think back to the schooner days, and there's a lot... Door County had so much going on. All these ships were coming here to take the stone and the lumber and the ice and, you know, let's plunder. And all the, and so they would lose ships and lose crew. So the shipping companies would go to Congress and say, we need lighthouses and we need life-saving stations. That's why there are more lighthouses on our 300 miles of shoreline than you'll find on any 300 miles of shoreline anywhere else in this country. It's because of those tragedies that happen, and the shipping companies got fed up with it and just went to Congress and said, we need something. So life-saving stations, lighthouses, eventually the Coast Guard coming in. There's even a really cool revenue cutter story from Washington Island where they caught some rum runners, and boy, the headlines in the paper were pretty... Nobody wanted them locked up on the island. Get them down to Sturgeon Bay.
Where we're out of rum.
Exactly. And Kevin mentioned, you know, a couple years ago, our friends at PBS Wisconsin did a great documentary on Wisconsin shipwrecks. This year, at the end of this year, they're going to be premiering their latest project, which is all about Wisconsin lighthouses. And one of the quotes from that preview trailer that we have running in the museum now is, without lighthouses, there's no Wisconsin. It was a huge part of our early history as a state, or as a territory first, and then as a state, to establish the economy of the state of Wisconsin by having all of the lighthouses, especially the ones that surround the Door Peninsula.
What was it like on the lighthouses back in those days? I mean, the earlier days. Do we have, I mean, surely in the museum you've got some
there's a lighthouse keeper in the audience somewhere.
There is. We have a plan. It was hard work. I mean, they were very lucrative jobs because it was a government job, came with a house.
It's prestigious.
A prestigious job, came with a house, came with a food allotment every year, but it was very hard work. I mean, I mentioned you had to climb up the 97 stairs, the spiral staircase, to go up to the top of the Cana Island Lighthouse.
Well, to be fair, it was the assistant keeper.
Well, somebody had to do it.
If you look at every lighthouse in Door County, they have the list of keepers, and there's a good list. But then you look at the list of assistant keepers, and it's 3 pages long. And the stories, there's one at Cana where the assistant keeper went to go get supplies, And then they got a telegram from Sturgeon Bay saying, I quit the lighthouse service. He was just gone. And in those days, think about where these lighthouses are. In those days, these were pretty remote places, very remote places. And it, while it was prestigious, it was also not the best duty.
And you had to climb up those stairs and carry, at, you know, the early fuel for those lighthouses was lard. So you had to carry buckets of lard up those spiral staircases probably at least twice, maybe three times every night, after night, throughout the entire shipping season. Until the water froze solid, there was a chance that there was going to be a boat out there, so you had to be available and you had to have that light lit to guide those mariners around the peninsula. So every night, three, four times a night, up you go with your love, buckets of lard, back down.
One of the guests at Cana Island asked is why the cast iron staircase, each step has holes in it. I said, well, probably when they spilled the oil, it just wouldn't sit on the step. It would just go down to the bottom of the, I don't know, it's probably just...
Yeah, and I was out at the Ridges Sanctuary in Bailey's Harbor, and where they have the range lights, so there are two lights separated by a very long boardwalk. So you had to do both of those lights every 4 hours with your buckets of lard, going back and forth from the oil house to the top of the upper range light, down the boardwalk, into the lower range light, go back, take a nap, repeat.
And then they upgraded to oil. And it was basically, these lights were basically like a Coleman lantern. They had a gas lantern with this Fresnel lens that would amplify that visual signal, like a cana goes out 17, 18 miles to the horizon. And if you'll notice that all the lighthouses, there's never one that's exactly the same next to another one. In the color of the light, in whether it's a flashing light or rotating light, they're different. And the reason was, there wasn't satellite navigation, and the charts weren't all that good. We have the very first nautical chart of the Bay of Green Bay on the wall in the Jim Crest Maritime Lighthouse Tower. North is on the right. And the only place where they had depths are places where the ship went and measured depths. So there's a large chunk of the bay that they had no idea how deep it was. You could track some of the depths right up until they ran aground and they stopped on that chart. So the lighthouses told them, if I'm looking at a constant white light, that's Cana. If they have a red high and a red low, but the red upper one is rotating, that's the entrance to the Sturgeon Bay Ship Canal. So they all had these different looks so the captains would know where they were.
And if you go to Peninsula State Park and when you're visiting Door County and you go to Eagle Bluff Lighthouse, you'll see Eagle Bluff Lighthouse, its companion, its twin, is out on Chambers Island, which is just off the shore of Fish Creek. Those two lighthouses are identical except for the shape of their lighthouse tower so that they could be differentiated by mariners even during the daytime. And then once you visit the Eagle Bluff Lighthouse, then, you know, hang out in the park and go see a show in Northern Sky.
There you go. Our guest is great talking with Sam Perlman and Kevin Osgood. Sam's the Deputy Director and Development Manager at Door County Maritime Museum, and Kevin Osgood's the Executive Director of the Door County Maritime Museum. And I'm Larry Mueller, and you are listening to WPR News. Thanks for joining in today. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today. Just to mention, tomorrow we've got another insect update from entomologist Phil Pelletieri, so get your bug pictures ready for what's sure to be another great show. But we are having some great fun in Sister Bay today, talking now about the Door County Maritime Museum. And great to have our two guests with us today as well, Sam Perlman and Kevin Osgood from the museum. Join in, numbers 800-642-1234, email to talk at wpr.org. Let's take a call from Ruben in Hudson, Wisconsin. Ruben, hi, thank you for calling.
I think a lady in your audience asked about the most famous shipwreck in Lake Michigan. Was there one back in the 60s? I think it was Morrell or something like that. Was that on Lake Michigan? I can't remember the first name of the ship.
Morrell?
That one is not familiar to me.
No.
But there were a lot over the years. Like Kevin said, there are over 275 known shipwrecks around just around the Door Peninsula, and those are the ones that we know of. And new ones are being discovered all of the time. So it's very likely. Again, if you want to look up wisconsinshipwrecks.org, that would be the place that would have the information, and they have a very good search function. So even if you have just a fraction of a name of the vessel, you may be able to find it on their website.
You know, there's some shipwrecks, as you were mentioning earlier, is one that we, at least they're looking and looking, they haven't been able to find it, but they're the most recent shipwreck discovery, I think, was the Trinidad?
Yes, that was just last year. Bob Jessic and Brendan Baylett, who were with the Wisconsin Underwater Archaeology Association, found that off the coast of Algoma in just about 275, 300 feet of water.
And what was the background on that ship?
Well, I'm going to read it because I'm not going to say that I actually have it memorized, but it was a 140-foot, two-masted schooner built in 1867 to carry grain from Wisconsin to the ports of the Eastern Great Lakes, lost in the spring of 1881 after exiting the Sturgeon Bay Ship Canal. Despite the actions of her crew at the pumps, she went down by the bow, trapping the captain's Newfoundland dog, who was the only casualty of the sinking.
Oh.
The crew rowed 10 miles to Onapee, which is now Algoma, in the overloaded yawl boat through high seas where they were cared for by the town's citizens.
That was an interesting, interesting story. And you wonder what took so long to find that particular, or was it because the ships themselves seem to be often in remarkably good condition. Talk about why that's the case.
It's the frigid waters at the bottom of the lakes, the Great Lakes, that remarkably preserves the shipwrecks that are at the bottom.
The temperature at the bottom of Lake Michigan stays pretty constant 12 months a year at roughly 38, 39 degrees, and that preserves the wood and the steel. And the invasive mussels that we have keep the water clear enough, which creates these amazing photos. And how are they found? There's a story of a shipwreck on the Bay of Green Bay, the Alvin Clark, and it was found by a fisherman whose nets got tangled in something. And this was found, it sank in 1869, and the ship was anchored. They were getting ready to go into Marinette the next day or Menominee and get some cargo, and a storm came up, so the hatch covers weren't on, and the waves, they tried to get underway, they tried to get to some safe harbor, but the waves, they took on too much water and they sank. So fast forward 100 years, and a fisherman's net gets tangled in something underwater, and they go down and find this boat. This was the mystery ship that Menominee is famous for, they have a little museum for. And they raised the ship up, and PBS Wisconsin did a documentary on this through UW Green Bay, and they raised the ship up and pulled it into Menominee and pumped it out, and the actual, there was no damage to it, 100-year-old schooner, and they actually used her actual bilge pumps, 100-year-old bilge pumps, to finish pumping her dry and turned her into an attraction. They put the masts back in. We have all this amazing video that you can see on the second floor of the Jim Crest Tower, but there was no preservation work done.
Oh.
And so as soon as that wood was exposed and started to dry out, it disintegrated, and in the end, it was bulldozed and burned and gone.
And that's why we tell that story in the museum in particular, because it's the cautionary tale of why we don't take things out of the lakes now, why it is illegal, why those shipwreck sites are part of the state and national historic register of historic places. They are all owned by the state of Wisconsin, and those artifacts and those shipwrecks need to remain in place, and so they can be studied underwater, and then they're shared by all of Wisconsin.
And that, like Sam said, that story is told on a couple different floors in the tower. The average guest who goes through probably wouldn't piece it together, but we did that intentionally to make it a school field trip experience, that when they're going through, we can tell that story about that ship and the preservation, and to get young people to have the same reaction you just did about preserving a piece of our past was important, and it is important, and it makes that happen. And that's another thing we want to take away in the museum's education program, is just get people to realize the amazing history we have here and respect it and learn from it.
And I'm thinking about some of the canoes. You have some dugout canoes from a long time back, do you not?
We do. Like Kevin talked about, you know, that one floor in the Jim Crest Maritime Lighthouse Tower that is predominantly talking about the Native American history around the peninsula. Those shipwrecks, those dugout canoes which were abandoned or lost, those really are the oldest shipwrecks in the state of Wisconsin. We happen to have two in our collection, one from about 1850, the other one from about 1870, and we just went through a really long restoration process with those. We got a conservator out of Illinois to come up. We got a grant, and we partnered with our friends in Manitowoc at the Manitowoc Historical Society and the Wisconsin Maritime Museum. Between the three organizations, we had four dugout canoes in our collections. We wanted to preserve them and be able to exhibit them and make those connections between contemporary maritime history and that really ancient maritime history and the indigenous peoples who were here first.
I'm wondering, you know, and you certainly probably don't have all the details of how that preservation process works, but, you know, I'm thinking, well, what would I do to kind of preserve something like that? I'd probably epoxy it or something, and I'm sure that's not what happens with those.
No, no, and one of the things that came from that was very customized cradles to hold these canoes so that as they get older, they don't continue, they don't deteriorate and break off. And one of them, I asked the team while they were there, why are there notches cut? There's two little square notches cut in one of the dugout canoes, and they turned and sort of rolled their eyes, and they said, well, before it was donated, it was hanging over somebody's mantle.
Oh.
So that again ties back to that. Let's respect and preserve the history and not.
And to that end, the Wisconsin Historical Society has a dugout canoe survey project that they have been working on for about half a dozen years now. And they have gone around the state to identify and document all or as many of the dugout canoes as they have been able to find. And I want to say what we have about 70 identified dugout canoes, some of which are 4,000 to 6,000 years old. I know there have been a lot of stories about Tamara Thompson, who's the state archaeologist with the Wisconsin, or state marine archaeologist with the Wisconsin Historical Society, who in her spare time on the weekends has gone diving in the lakes around Madison and
Mendota
found,
in particular.
And found two of the oldest shipwrecks on record in the state of Wisconsin on her off days.
Yeah.
And it's something else that the conservators pointed out, Wisconsin has a great number of these and only Florida has more. And I said, oh, okay. And they said, no, but wait. Florida had like 200 really small ones in one lake, so let's ignore that. Wisconsin has the most.
Except for that one lake in
Except
Florida.
Except for that one lake.
You know, thinking about boats, I know that I wanted to make sure, before we run out of time, for sure, to talk about some of the events that are coming up. How long have you've been running a boat raffle for?
27
years. This is hull number 27. So we have a wooden boat building workshop in the museum in Sturgeon Bay. We have a group of dedicated volunteer instructors who every year lead a small class through the construction from nothing all the way up to building a small wooden vessel. It's an outstanding vessel every year. This year it's a 16-foot shearwater rowboat. They donate that vessel back to the museum and then we raffle it off. You can come see it at the museum in Sturgeon Bay. We'll have it at festivals, events around the county all summer long. And then at Sister Bay Fall Fest that Saturday, we raffle it off and winner need not be present. And honestly, it could be the best $20 you've ever spent.
I knew it was coming. Sam's the development manager. I'm surprised he didn't bring raffle tickets to sell while we were here.
Well, I have to tell you that I have been been at the Bailey's Harbor 4th of July parade, and I have many a year purchased one of those tickets.
And you have yet to win the boat?
We appreciate the support.
But you know what? I know it's always, I never expect to win, but it's always for a good cause. And so
and that's just one of the education programs. That's an adult education program. Now we do underwater robotics and ROVs for middle school students, and we have summer camps that do the same thing. The education program that the museum has now is really phenomenal and really moving forward. And we have the Sea Perch competition is a middle school underwater robotics competition in Washington Island, Wisconsin, the smallest school system in the state. Has owned this. They have been an international competition three times, internationals, and this past year at internationals, out of 77
71 teams?
71 teams.
And I think they placed 19th.
Ninth or 19th?
19th.
19th in the world from Washington Island, Wisconsin. So that's fantastic. They deserve a lot of congratulations for that.
That's wonderful. And there's an event coming up, what is it, August 8th, 2nd through the 9th in Sturgeon Bay.
Yes, it's Sturgeon Bay Maritime Week, a salute to the U.S. Coast Guard. So the city of Sturgeon Bay is one of 34 official U.S. Coast Guard cities and the only one in Wisconsin. We celebrate with a variety of events throughout that week. It's, of course, timed for the Coast Guard's official birthday, which is August 4th, and it always kicks off with the Classic and Wooden Boat Show at the Door County Maritime Museum. There's the Mariner Awards Dinner, we have a Coast Guard golf outing, and then we culminate that week with a free picnic at the museum for active and retired Coast Guard and their families.
And that's a lot of fun. At the beginning, at the Classic and Wooden Boat Show, though, we have to mention Sikaflex. How many, if you've ever seen the Sikaflex competition right there at the museum.
No, I have not.
On Saturday, we'll have 7 to 12 teams. We have 7 now. By then, we'll probably have a dozen. And they get 4 hours. They get 6 sheets of Luan plywood and some 1x1s and some glue. And they have to build a boat. And then they get time to decorate that. And then on Sunday at midday, we race them. There have been years where only one boat made it through the course, where all but one sank at the dock. Design is important.
Design is
very important. But the things that people put on these boats. One year, a team of Coast Guard people built a boat, and then they went out and intentionally sank it and fired off flares, and in cahoots with their shipmates, they drove a rescue boat in and saved them.
In the name of teaching maritime safety.
We did a show a couple weeks ago about the Coast Guard. It was really a lot of fun to talk with them about the great work that they have done, and then I tell you what, it's been great fun talking with you two about the great work that you're doing.
Well, thank you. We've enjoyed it. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks so much.
It's been great fun. Sam Perlman is Deputy Director and Development Manager at the Door County Maritime Museum. Kevin Osgood is Executive Director of the museum as well. I should mention that Door County Maritime Museum is one of our many great underwriters for Wisconsin Public Radio, and we've much appreciated that as well as we move along. And I want to thank everybody for joining us today. You know, this show and all the shows that we do are a team effort. We've got producers Claire Neipert and Joel Patnaud, and I've got a few names I did want to mention today. Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins are normally our technical directors, or they always are. Executive director, of course, everybody's boss, Jill Nadeau. But I also wanted to thank Katie Lang, our regional director, for doing this, and Tom Blaine and Tyler Ditter, who set up our recording work along with Lee. And of course, Sarah Ashworth, our WPR director. All great to have, and they love doing it. I love doing it, and I love the audience that we have here in person and the one that we have listening. Thank you so much for being with us here today, and we'll do it again tomorrow. I'm Larry Mueller.